From Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Thursday. It's October 21st, 37 degrees in Old Town Park City. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Good morning, Cesar.
Good morning, Leslie. And we continue to see a great kind of day ahead of us here for Park City and most of the Wasatch back, as we are expecting to see more and more sunshine thanks to those dissipating clouds. We'll see a high of 58 and a low of 36 with mostly clear skies for us going into tonight. Friday, we do it all over again, a mostly sunny kind of day, if not downright sunny at times, with plenty of warmth. We're going to see a high of 59. And as we go into Friday night, we'll start to see our cloud cover increase and have a low of 36. Going into Saturday, we have a little quick hitting system that is poised to bring us some possible rain and high elevation snow thanks to some wet weather along with this system that does continue into the evening time frame for us. We'll see a high of 48 and a low of 34. Going to Sunday, we'll see some spotty chance showers continuing to linger for us, but not a complete washout kind of a day. As we go into Sunday night, that chance still continues, but we'll slowly fizzle out. We'll see a high of 50 on Sunday and a low of 40 on Sunday night. Going into Monday, we're continuing to see more possible rain thanks to a larger system making its way in. We'll see that we'll have a high of 56 going into Monday, and Monday night we can expect to still see rain and cloudy conditions with a low of 33. Going to Tuesday, that's where the temperatures start to drop, where we could possibly see some high elevation snow and even possibly some reaching towards parts of the valley, leaving us with a little bit of a slick morning commute. We'll see a high of 40 for us on Tuesday. Going into Tuesday night, we start to slowly dry out, but still seeing those chances of rain and snow hanging around with a low of 29. Going into Wednesday, we'll start to slowly dry out as well, with just a light amount of snow possibly still hanging around for us as we continue to dry out as well with a high of 44. From the ABC Forecast Center, I'm meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Over to you, Leslie.
Okay, thanks, Cesar. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Council Member Melina Stevens. Later on, Park City Environmental Sustainability Manager Luke Carton has details about Tuesday's groundbreaking of the new Electron Solar Farm and how it will make a difference as climate change continues to threaten the ski industry and mountain communities that rely on tourism. Finally, Park City Film Director Katie Wang with a monthly update on some of the upcoming films and special screenings taking place at the Jim Santee Auditorium. Morning. Well, the Summit County Council met yesterday, and on the phone with a recap, I have Council Member Melina Stevens. Good morning, Melina.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the council approved the tax abatements for the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Center of Excellence, the Park City Historical Society, the Roman Catholic Bishop of Salt Lake, and Park City Tots. These are nonprofit organizations that have operated for years. How is it that they missed the filing deadline this year?
You know, there was a few different factors that came into play. That with the nonprofits, every year they need to go through and ensure that their status is corrected and that they get those tax abatements. From what I understand, that there was some issues as far as with the noticing from the county, as well as the organizations not catching that due to whatever reason. So as a council, we thought it was appropriate that those organizations, as you stated, that have been operating as nonprofits and really serving our community for such a long time should be able to have that exemption this year, with the understanding that next year the deadlines would need to be abided by.
Yeah, so the county making that mistake on noticing, can you tell us what happened there?
From what I understand, that there was not a certified notice that went out. It was just a normal notice. It sounded like, from the information that we received, that there was just several mistakes kind of all the way around. And so we wanted to make sure that those organizations that are serving our community are not penalized for mistakes, regardless of whose mistakes those were.
Okay. Will any changes be made to avoid it in the future?
So the county auditor indicated that in the future, the tax abatement notices for the nonprofits would go out as certified mail so that they would get the notice specifically that it had been delivered to those organizations. Those organizations have also been put on notice just through this process that that is something that they'll need to pay more attention to in the future.
All right. During council comments, the Park City leadership class asked if Summit County could help on some kind of survey relating to redistricting. The details were unclear. Can you tell us what the request was to the council?
So leadership Park City, the current class, requested that we assist with their project, which surrounds the redistricting through the state of Utah. So with that project, currently Summit County is represented by five different members of our legislature, none of whom live within Summit County. And so part of what they're trying to determine is that what Summit County residents would like? Is it something that they would like to have one or two representatives that are for our county, whether from this different bodies within the state legislature? And so with that, they had a couple of different requests. Parts of it were a little more than as a county we could do, as the deadline is this Saturday. So we ultimately determined that we'll be pushing out some sort of social media noticing for that. People can also individually, in line with this project, go to betterboundaries.com and submit things, submit a map and their opinion on this nonpartisan issue, just themselves as well, aside from Leadership Park City. But that's something, as we get that information, that we'll be posting online to ensure that our community understands the significance of this and how they can participate.
All right. Also mentioned by County Manager Tom Fisher was that the Council of Governments, for the Council of Governments meeting this winter, the county would like to talk with the mayors about regional planning. Did he get into any specifics there? Or?
So we had a meeting that was scheduled for a week or two ago to essentially initiate this process. We've had COG meetings, the Council of Government meetings, for a very long time. And they've been focused on varying issues, but we really wanted to utilize that group to be able to really forward regional collaboration on different initiatives so that we're not essentially having different general plans that are in conflict, that we can work together wherever possible to be able to support all of our constituents. And so with some scheduling issues, we ultimately determined last night that we would use the next regularly scheduled COG meeting at the end of November to be able to really start digging into this process, what it might look like, how we can better collaborate to really serve all members of the county in a more cohesive way, really assist each other and not step on each other's toes or ever have anyone feeling like they're being dictated to, because that's not the intention and that's not what we're working for. We need collaboration.
By that time, we'll know if the $50 million open space bond was approved or rejected by voters. How will that affect the discussion of what happens with the Camas Meadows?
I mean, at this point, I think that the conversations that we're looking at are a little broader. If the bond is passed, and we'll see what happens in just a couple weeks, that may shift the conversations in the future. Really, there's a lot of different factors that are at play currently.
Okay, and that was pretty much it for the agenda yesterday. I'm real quick. What would you like to see from the 2022 budget?
With the 2022 budget, I would really like to see an emphasis with supporting our law enforcement and our other first responders, making sure that we are competitive enough to continue that level of service that our communities have become accustomed to. Right now, it's a really competitive market, and there's not a massive pipeline for new officers, and so that's something that is a massive focus for me, given just my background with Park City Police Department as well, and all the collaborations with the Sheriff's Department. It's a challenging line of work. Also making sure that we are paying attention to our planning department, our code enforcement, as we have different growth pressures in varying areas of the county, that we're really serving the community in the way that the community deserves to be served.
It sounded like the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission was going to be looking for some money to do some kind of visioning. It's been 10 years or so since we've done it. Is there money in the budget to do that?
That's something that I would anticipate would be put within our planning department, and we have not gotten into the granular details at this point. We will in the coming weeks, and I would encourage all members of the public to listen in and participate in those meetings, especially during our public comment portion of that, because the budget is really what dictates what we are and are not able to do as a county. And if there's something that's really important to you as a member of the public, please let us know as we're going through this budget season. It's one of the most impactful times of the year as far as our programming.
All right. And I'd also like to get your response, Melina, on the ongoing Elk Meadows issue. The county has decided not to fine the Elk Meadows property owner, a multi-million dollar corporation, for not having a business license for the last year and a half. Certainly, this is not the council's decision. I understand that. But I'm guessing, I mean, if anybody can afford a fine, I mean, wouldn't it be a corporation like this?
So as you stated, it's not the council's decision as far as with that specific issue. I will say with affordable housing, we want to make sure that we're being sensitive to the needs of the residents, that we're responsive. And with it's a fairly complicated issue, ensuring that those residents have homes and that their homes are safe, and something that has been given a lot of attention by varying departments within the county for quite some time to ensure that that happens. So number one for me, speaking for myself, is ensuring the safety of those residents as well as them continuing to be able to have that home within our county.
Yeah. I guess just given all of the staff time, everything from the attorney's department to the building and the health departments, lots of staff services went to ensure that they were in compliance with our health codes. And it just seems like at least we could get reimbursed by a business that can afford it. I mean, we certainly are on record having, you know, finding people who don't have a business license, you know, out selling magazines, you know, to go to camp.
Yeah, again, with that, we want to make sure that there's no repercussions for the residents that live there. And it becomes a complicated issue with a lot of businesses. You can revoke their licenses and say, well, you just can't operate until you are in compliance. When you have a housing unit, what does that look like? Does that look like eviction? Does that look like, how is that implicated within their business model? And I think that's one thing that the county has been paying strict attention to, because we're not interested in vulnerable populations being evicted because of issues with their ownership. We want those problems fixed. We want those people to not be displaced if we can help that.
Sure. And if somebody doesn't comply with business license law, I mean, who does somebody complain to? I mean, does that go to the code enforcement department, the sheriff's deputy?
I mean, at this point, that would be a civil matter. I mean, they can absolutely contact our sheriff's office if it's some sort of active situation. But the county attorney's office would likely be the place that would be best to contact in those matters, as they have a considerable expertise in that area.
Okay. Finally, just wanted to ask, were you there for the groundbreaking Tuesday for the new solar farm that Summit County is going to be part of?
You know, unfortunately, I was not able to attend. Our chair, Glenn Wright, was able to attend with some staff members, and it was a wonderful event. I think it's very exciting that we're at a place where we're really actively pursuing renewable sources of energy in a very progressive and active way, and I'm excited to see it materialize.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to mention, Melina?
Just again, as we come with our budget cycle, really encouraging all members of the public to participate. It can seem maybe not as exciting as some other topics that we cover, but it's extremely impactful. Also, as we're looking at the boundary redistricting. If people are interested in that nonpartisan issue, encourage them to go to thebetterboundaries.com and to participate and have their voices heard in all levels of government.
Okay, Melina Stevens, I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Melina Stevens is a member of the Summit County Council. Well, the price to bring a Smith's Marketplace to Heber City could be less than previously believed. KPCW's Ben Lassiter has more on the City Council's vote this week to take the next step.
Rather than $7 million, the city could pull off the deal for less than $2 million, the Heber City Council learned Tuesday. On October 5th, the council heard Smith's required an incentive to open a store in northern Heber City. A Smith's representative said out of a total road cost of $11 million, the city had to cover $7 million, and the council had until this Friday to agree to the terms. A review by city staff painted a different picture of the city's obligation. Councilman Mike Johnston tells KPCW it's a much more manageable figure.
The $7 million that came out 2 weeks ago was a initial stab at what the developer thought was our portion. We have gone through and looked at that with our staff, and they have determined that that portion that we are liable for is really only about $1.2 million. So somewhere between 1.2 and 7, we feel it's going to be more closer to the 1.2.
The city voted 3-1 to approve a memorandum of understanding to do the deal. The MOU formally states the city will reach a development agreement in the future, but comes with no legal obligation. Councilwoman Heidi Franco was the dissenting vote, and Councilman Wayne Hardman was away on vacation. The MOU also specifies the city has to be ready to build the road at the same time Smith's is building the store. That could begin as early as next spring.
The MOU says that we commit that we will work with Smith's to do our portion of the road, and how we finance that is up to us, whether it's a public infrastructure bond or whether it's just cash and impact fees or whether we do some other financing. An MOU is non-binding. It's not a legal contract. But it shows our good faith that we will comply with what Smith is asking.
The store would be the first major component of an economic development project to build up the downtown and generate new tax dollars. By creating a community reinvestment area financial strategy, the city could use a big chunk of new tax revenue from the Smiths to reinvest in other projects downtown. Also at the Tuesday meeting, the council approved a final change to the sawmill development. Located east of the Heber Valley Hospital, the site will now include an elementary school.
There's going to be about 1,000 residential units in this area, which in our county means about 1,000 school kids, or 600 elementary school kids, which is an elementary school. And so the school district realized this was a really important place to get an elementary school.
The amendment makes a few other changes. It eliminates senior housing, offers reduced rent for police officers, and lets the commercial buildings be built up to 4 stories. Residents who came to a public hearing on August 3rd opposed the amendment. Several neighbors to the sawmill development complained the multi-level buildings would eliminate their views of Mount Timpanogos. Some called the amendment process rushed and unfair. The next Heber City Council meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, November 2nd. Ben Lassiter, KPCW News.
Ground was broken Tuesday on the new 80-megawatt solar farm in Tooele that will allow Park City and Summit County to meet its net zero goals for city operations by 2023. In the studio with details, I have Park City Environmental Sustainability Manager Luke Carton. Good morning, Luke.
Good morning, Leslie.
So this is known as the Electron Solar Project. How much is it going to cost in total?
So the total project cost, I don't have it off the top of my head. It's in the high tens of millions of dollars. So it's a 80 megawatt it's tens of acres of site, right? So it's a large project, and it's enough when you think about it to power all of our city operations, Summit County government, like 80% or so of Salt Lake City government's operations, electricity side, our 2 ski resorts and Utah Valley University. So when you start thinking about it, it's over 200,000 solar panels going out to that site.
Okay. How much of that is Park City's share?
Park City's share is in the ballpark of, I believe, 15-ish%, 20-ish%. Mm-hmm. Salt Lake City's the big user there. I mean, when you think about the airport and all this other stuff. But yeah, we're in that, I want to say, 15-ish% range.
Okay. Is there more property? I mean, could this be expanded if needed?
No, that's a great question. So really quick, the site is kind of in the middle of nowhere. If you ever go on Google Maps, it's just south of the U.S. Magnesium plant on the western shores of the Great Salt Lake. It's actually on an old Superfund site. It is on SITLA land, so the lease payments will go to pay to build and maintain schools and that side of it. And there is some land around it. The question is, you know, do you expand more solar? Could you eventually put in battery storage there to match up more of the grid needs? There is some site flexibility around there. And then also, truthfully, there's just a lot of, it's just flat land. And like I said, it's not a place that anyone wants to build homes or anything like that. It's kind of out there in the middle of nowhere and kind of an industrial area. So it's a good spot for large scale solar.
Yeah. So would people be able to see it, say, driving, you know, west on I-80?
You won't be able to see it there, but actually, if you're flying in to the Salt Lake City Airport, when you sometimes do one of those big swooping moves over the Great Salt Lake, you'll actually be able to see it there. Sometimes you can see the U.S. Mag plant. It's like this manufacturing plant just kind of stuck in the middle of nowhere. It'll just be a couple miles to the south of that, and it'll just like rows of solar panels. It's about the same size. If you ever drive on I-70 and you see those solar fields just east of the I-15 split, it's about that same size.
Yeah. So how does this work then? I mean, Park City's paying what to have 15 to 20% of the energy that's produced?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, when you think about our grid overall, right, there is no generating stations right in town or anything like that. We're tied into a 6-state grid. And what we do is this is called a net 100 goal. So we make sure that there's the same amount of solar put on the grid that we use in a year. So it's the easiest way to truthfully to do the math and trying to match up hour by hour, minute by minute. This is how a lot of these large scale power purchase agreements are done. So what we did was we went out and pulled together this coalition of all the aforementioned groups, worked with Rocky Mountain Power, went through an RFP process and selected a project that works. If you're a large electricity user above something called 5 megawatt demand, which is like our ski resorts, the city, you can go out under Rocky Mountain Power, and there's two different options you can do to actually go out and procure, do a power purchase agreement. It's called Schedule 34. It was originally created to help lure in the Facebooks of the world. Facebook actually uses this quite a bit. So you can go through and Rocky Mountain Power signs a power purchase agreement with the solar facility or wind facility or whatever it is. And what happens is they compare the avoided costs. So bringing that power online, that's saving them some money, right? Because Rocky Mountain Power doesn't have to do that. And then they just look at the difference between that and the power purchase cost, right? What it costs to bring the power on. And then something else called network upgrades. So you can view it as you have the solar or wind array, you got to plug it into the grid and make it work with the grid too. So that's a part of it too. So with these large customers, you can go out and actually procure these things. So what we're doing is we're saying, hey, we're paying the net difference. And for the city, it's going to be less than 2%, especially for the first few years. And the interesting thing, Leslie, is we can actually shield ourselves from long-term natural gas and hedging things. So if anyone ever looks at their power bill, on the bottom of it, there's something called the EBA, the Energy Balancing Account. And that is kind of the fudge factor they use for when natural gas prices go up or down, or coal goes up or down, or anything that goes into the grid. And we'll be able to shield ourselves from some of that because we're contributing to the grid a lot of clean energy that's also zero cost fuel. So over not even the long term, over just a few years, we actually view that really nominal price increase to be null or truthfully, hopefully a savings over time as well. So it's just a long-term hedge when you think about it.
Okay, so again, I mean, in terms of what Park City, in terms of money, real money putting into this project, what's budgeted?
Real money, it's coming right into our power bills. So it's the interesting thing is, so our city's electricity bills in like the almost $2.5 million range annually. When you think of not only street lights, but the MARC, the library, the buses are a big part of it. And water's just over half of our electricity needs as well, because we pump water everywhere. So it's, like I said, it'll be, if you look at it, it's just like adding another little line to your overall power bill. And like I said, it'll be, you know, kind of the worst case scenario will put us just like in that 1.5% range of an increase. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, our power bills fluctuate by sometimes upwards of 8 or 10% a year just from different usages and stuff like that. So we've really balanced out that 1.5%, and we've redoubled our efficiency side to lessen that impact as well.
All right. So this is the farm is basically owned by this business Desri.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just paying them then for the power? I mean, how are they going to recoup their costs?
Yeah. So we don't own it, right? So we are customers. We are buying. They, and again, it's Utah, so nothing, and it's Utah electricity, so it's not as straightforward. So they sell the power to Rocky Mountain Power. through a contract, and we buy the power from Rocky Mountain Power through a contract as well. We're not allowed to directly interact with them. But yeah, so we're just a long-term hedge. So we just said, hey, we're signing up to take 20 years of your power.
Okay. So they're putting multi-million dollars into this with the hope that there's payback.
Yeah, I mean, to put it in ballpark figures, I mean, this will be in the, you know, $80 to $100 million range of investment. And when you start looking at this in Utah, there was just a study that came out in Deseret News had an article about it just last week, or you can just Google the Western Way. They produce it. It's a conservative think tank, and there's 34 renewable energy projects in Utah that have either been built or are currently being built. Electron's kind of one of it. It's over $5 billion of economic benefit for the state, over $180 million a year. It's a really interesting study to read. And again, the great thing about this project is, yeah, it's providing us with electricity. It's on a site that is literally Superfund style. It's in a not it's not like in the middle of vast open space or up here, you know. And we always get asked, well, why don't you build it up here, right? And it's like, well, out there there's a lot of space, there's less snow, and up here, you know, we have space restrictions for open space is key for us. We also have affordable housing. But the other cool thing is the project also pays CITLA lease payments, and then on top of it too, it also creates, it's creating a couple hundred construction jobs. It's a massive site. And then over the long term, there'll actually be staff that will maintain it. So you have that. So you have jobs that are going into Tooele County. And on top of it, they also receive a property tax base. So it's a huge win for Utah. And that's what we're trying to do with the House Bill 411 stuff, too, is to drive one of these projects into rural parts of the state.
So when's it going to be finished? I mean, when are we going to start pulling power?
Great question. So we are on track to get it finished kind of mid of 2022. And then right when COVID hit, it messed up all the financial markets. So we actually had to go and change around the contracts and work through some things. So right now the project is scheduled to be completed the fourth quarter of 2022, or maybe it could slide into the first quarter of 2023. It is a massive construction site, and you know, we're on the optimistic side, and we were just out at the site talking to the GC, and they're on track. They're still cruising along, but they're shooting for right at the end of 2022 to get it up, running, and tested.
Okay. And I guess just to clarify for people, it's like, it's not that we're building this so this power gets somehow shipped to us. It's really just a transfer of power. Rocky Mountain uses the power wherever it needs, and we still just get the power from wherever we get it from.
Yeah, so this is kind of like how physics work and other things work, right? So the truthfully, it's nice because it's when we went through the project selection, it's one of the closest sites to us, and it ties right into the transmission lines that pull into Salt Lake City. So, you know, on the physics side, every electron that goes on gets, you know, slid around. But also, truthfully, if you have rooftop solar, your house isn't always using it. Your neighbors are using it and stuff like that. So then you get to take a step back and see how is just renewable electricity accounted for? And unless it's literally tied to directly your meter or behind your meter, you are using the grid to do that. So like I said before, the power that's powering the lights in this studio are coming from a mix of six different states worth of power. So it's an accounting exercise of, well, what's responsible for bringing that power on? Park City area, roughly 70-ish% of our electricity comes from coal resources, 60 to 70%. And we're saying, hey, we want to account for bringing more renewables on that we can take credit for, because the Electron project would not have been built if it weren't for these six customers. So we can take credit for bringing it online. We can reap the costs and benefits of it as well. So that's just how all the accounting works on just the grid overall. It's not like you can, you know, for us to put solar panels and let's say run the bus charger out there, it would have to be the size of like the Walmart parking lot, right? And you think, well, the Old Town Transit Center, we wouldn't be able to tie that all in. So just when these large things happen, that's.
At some point, people were asked to subscribe to this. And did you get a good response to that? I mean, is that people are now part of this?
A little bit different. Deal? So this was a bunch of customers coming together to go out and seek a direct project. Then Rocky Mountain Power also has two other programs, and Park City actually has really high participation in both of them. One's called Blue Sky Solar, which is people pay a nominal fee on their bills, and it goes to put solar on like public buildings or, you know, nonprofits and that side of it. And then there's also Subscriber Solar, which is still, I believe, capped. It's sold out currently, and people could buy, you know, you'd pay for a certain amount of panels, and there's a solar farm south of here that you would get credit for that as well. But I think the interesting thing is when you're looking forward to the Utah renewable communities. That project will be up and running by 2030, and then you'll have the option to just have your default electricity for whether you're a business or resident or nonprofit in the town to be 100% renewable.
So rooftop solar panels last 20, maybe 25 years if you're lucky, I guess. Mm-hmm. How long are these going to last? I mean, is that built in then to replace these all the time?
Correct. Yeah, so it's rooftop solar panels, they're getting a little bit better, but yeah, that you can put them in like that 25-ish, maybe 30-year lifespan. And the great thing about it too is because the infrastructure is there to replace the panels and upgrade the panels, it's kind of a good site for into the future. Our contract only goes 20 years. And then after that, we can reassess, or we might just slide into the community renewable energy pool. The great thing is we'll have multiple options to get us to 100%. The other big thing is hopefully, solar panel recycling is, I'm not going to say it's great. It's hopefully getting better, and it is getting better every single year. There was a big kerfuffle about wind turbine blades and stuff like that. There are markets out there that are developing, and that's a major part of it as well, is to making sure we're not just creating electronic waste. We want to really help push and get creative and figuring out how to reuse solar panels as well into the future.
All right. And so after this, then, how does the city get the rest of the community to meet the 2030 goal, and that being community-wide, not just city operations?
Great question. So there is something called the Utah Community Renewable Energy Agency. So there are currently 15 communities that are part of a multi-jurisdictional board that we're meeting monthly right now. And right now, we're just going through the process. These 15 communities have all aligned to be 100% renewable electricity by 2030. We're gonna be working through a program, filing it with the Public Service Commission with Rocky Mountain Power to say, hey, we want to create this opt-out program. So then everyone in our communities will have the option to be 100% renewable by 2030. The other thing too is, Rocky Mountain Power has gone in the past 5 years. If you go through their kind of longer term resource planning, it's called the Integrated Resource Plan. Their original goal for the 2030 range was in like the 30-ish percent range. Now they're up in the 80th percent range. And it isn't because Rocky Mountain Power all of a sudden has, they have good people there that care for and want to be stewards of the environment. But it's truthfully, it's now becoming the cheapest source of electricity. So it's the question is for 100% goal, we're going to kind of close the gap, right? We don't need to build additional renewables, but if Rocky Mountain Power is at 80% of the grid, we're going to go out and find projects that'll get us that last 20%. And again, as that gap gets smaller and smaller, and people always say, what's the bill impact going to be? And we're going to model that all out. It's going to be all public, but truthfully, I think it's going to be like nominal. Like, I don't even think you'll be able to tell the difference. I mean, we're talking like pennies. So,
meanwhile, a new report was published by Utah State University recently that investigates the effects of climate change on ski resorts across the state. The findings are troubling. Have you had a chance to look at that?
Yeah, thanks for sharing it with me. It was pretty eye-opening.
Yeah, so just to give a brief summary, I mean, the study shows many resorts in Utah warming faster than global averages and minimum temperatures rising faster than the maximum temperatures. And by the end of the century, winters in Utah, basically December through March, we'll see its minimum daily temps warm an additional 6 degrees Celsius in the north here. That doesn't sound good at all.
No, it's pretty hard to find positive climate news right now. And I think the other thing too is, that when I worked in the ski industry as well, and we hear it all the time of like, there's studies on the ski resort side, but if you look at what like our ranchers are going through on the east side right now, they've been living through a horrendous drought, and these things are just kind of multiplying. So if we get bad snow, we won't be able to ski, but it also, Utah is kind of an island for water as well. So the interesting things on the report I saw was, the warming side, but also that kind of Utah powder, the super dry stuff it's happening less and less. And you start, you add that in with the Great Salt Lake shrinking way down. You look at, back in June, McLeod Creek was at a record low already. So it's not great news. Even just this past month, the flows out of Rockport got cut to pretty much zero, right? So you think of not only, hey, that kills recreation and fisheries and that side of it, also really hurts the ranch. It hurts like generations of ranchers and agriculture as well. So it's pretty eye-opening.
So the results, as you kind of mentioned, shorter ski seasons, less snow cover, poor snow quality. So is this solar farm? I mean, is that just too little, too late?
It's a great question, right? I think you could say that for all climate action. Is everything kind of too little, too late? I mean, it's... But I think, you know, just last night, so Colorado Association for Ski Towns is in town, and we hosted them, and we actually had Gina McCarthy speak, and it was, you know, that was kind of one of the questions that always gets brought up. But I think one of the ways that I try to keep myself sane and not get bummed out about it too much is if you look at, you know, it's 2021 now, and our goals for 2030, right? But let's look back 9 years, right, back to 2012. You would have never thought that Rocky Mountain Power would have gone to such aggressive renewable goals. You never thought GM would say, we're going to stop making internal combustion engines. You know, GM, Volvo, like you can Jaguar, you can list the, I mean, all the, almost all, I believe almost all the engine manufacturer or the large vehicle manufacturers are going to go fully electric. So there are some major things moving. It's just a question of, are we moving fast enough, right? So we have the Glasgow COP26, which is, you know, everyone heard of the Paris Accords. This is kind of the next version of it. Is just happening. It starts at the end of this month and runs through mid-November, and it's not always it's not the most chipper news. So that's why we're really focusing on this action and ambition, right? Setting a 2050 goal, you're going to talk about too little, too late. So that's why we really set these goals.
Right, Utah, as we know, already seeing the decreased snowpack depths, and yet we're still seeing record ski days. What's going to happen, I mean, to continue to bring the people here is increased snowmaking, which not only includes adding chemical additives to make snow production possible, but it means we're using more water. So, I mean, are we kind of like cutting off, you know, our nose to spite our face?
Yeah.
I mean, right?
And again, on the snowmaking side, too, so there is... I'll just quickly hit on this point, and not meant to be the main focus, but the chemical additive thing, that usually doesn't happen. If it is, it's a derivative of strawberries. It's called Snowmax. But chemical, it's mostly just air, water, and a lot of electricity. So it's really high cost to do that. And snowmaking snow is not great. You know, like you never get excited to go skiing early December. So I think that's kind of the interesting thing to figure this out. Now, that being said, one of the other interesting things is we're seeing, you know, the droughts last longer, but the storms hit fiercer. So we're going to have a season, and my guess would be in the next 3 to 5 seasons, that's going to be record book snow. We're going to, you know, be swimming in snow, and people are going to be like, look, we're good, we're safe. What we're doing is, the way I describe it is that the kind of the climatic atmospheres that we're in is kind of like a kid, right? And if you gave a kid a lot of candy, they could be really happy. They could also be really angry, but you're kind of rolling the dice, right? And what we're seeing is we're more likely to have drought than we are to have excess snow. But when we have those excess snow, it's going to come in super, super fierce. So it's going to be this kind of pull and tug on it. So now you overlay the skiers on top of it and trying to, you might see more people kind of chasing the snow around, right? Let's say Jackson has a really good year or Whitefish has a really good year. People might just say, well, I'm going to go up there instead of Park City or, you know, so I think you're going to start seeing folks do that more often because, you know, you can see what happened in Tahoe the past few years. They had no snow, record snow, no snow, you know, so we're going to see more of that kind of variability.
Yeah. And you're the guy that really knows all of this doom and gloom. I mean, I guess at that point, I mean, are you leading the discussion then in terms of what the city's plan is to diversify in the event that, you know, we don't have a ski season?
I am not the great thing about this community is we have truly a lot of amazing and smart people. You know, like when we were talking about some potential climate finance stuff, we pulled in like Peter Tomei and Sean Kelleher and like folks who actually live and breathe in this world. So yeah, everyone's got ideas, but that's not a single decision. That is a massive community conversation. But I think it's one of these things that the sooner we have to start talking about what are our strengths and how can we capitalize on it, that's what'll help us, you know, be more resilient in the future.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to add, Luke?
No, those are the big pieces. Again, love to hear from folks. So if people want to reach out, just luke.carton@parkcity.org, and happy to chat anytime.
All right. Luke, appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
It's Luke Carton again, Park City Environmental Sustainability Manager. Well, speaking of Rocky Mountain Power, crews today will be conducting work via helicopter in near Park City's Old Town. The helicopter scheduled to be flying low at times and expected to hover this morning, sometime between 9 and 11 a.m., Deer Valley Drive and Airy Drive. Rocky Mountain Power will be replacing 4 poles in that area. Impacted customers have been notified of the planned power outage associated with the work. That's expected to run about 9 to 4 today. The work is being conducted as part of the power company's wildfire safety and mitigation efforts. Crews will be working to restore power as quickly as possible. Well, the Park City Film Series presenting the film The Alpinist today, Friday through Sunday at the Jim Sandy Auditorium, and on the phone with a preview of this and some of the other screenings coming up, I've got Katie Wang, Executive Director of Park City Film. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So,
good to be here.
Yeah, so tell us about this weekend's film.
So this weekend, we've actually got two films. I don't know if you know, back in the day, it used to be the norm that movie theaters would show short films before the feature. So we're kind of doing a little throwback this weekend with a special film on Friday night. But the weekend film, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, is a documentary called The Alpinist. And it's kind of an edge-of-your-seat film about one of the world's greatest ice climbers, Marc-André Leclerc, who just really redefines what's possible in solo climbing. So if you're familiar with Free Solo and Alex Honnold, imagine that, but just done on ice. So definitely nail-biting film there. And then on Friday, we have a special presentation before the feature film runs of a short film called Journey to 100. And this is about ultra runner Jason Hardrith, who is a PE teacher from Oregon, whose goal is to become the first person to climb all of Washington State's 100 tallest peaks in record time. So achieving 100 fastest known times for those who live in that world. And that's part of our Made in Utah film series. The filmmakers are here local to us in Park City. So if you want to come see a special screening on Friday night, that'll be kind of a double feature. The short film runs about 30 minutes and then the feature is about 90 minutes. So just kind of a great complement of each other there. I just want to thank PJ Builders for making it all possible this weekend. They're the weekend underwriter, which helps us with all of our films.
Okay, what else have you got coming up?
So we are, you know, back in action at the Santee. We've closed up the drive-in and just want to give a big shout out to everyone who came to that. We had over 2,000 cars joining us this past summer. Great partnership, of course, with Utah Olympic Park and Dragonfly Media Technologies. And now looking forward, we've got kind of a selection of films that celebrate the spirit of adventure and love of the outdoors that defines our community here in Park City. So after The Alpinist this weekend, we have a documentary that premiered at the 2021 Sundance Film Festival called My Name is Pauli Murray. And this is about a pioneering non-binary Black lawyer, activist, and Episcopal priest, she did many things, who shaped landmark litigation and consciousness around race and gender equity, but whose name was really largely unknown to the general public. Hopefully this film will change that. It's by directors Julie Cohen and Betsy West, who famously brought us RBG about Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and they do a fantastic job with Pauli Murray. We'll have a panel discussion on Saturday night after the film about thriving in the fullness of our complex lives. And then for Live PC, Give PC, we have programmed the film The Rescue, which is directed by Jimmy Chin and Chai Vassarelli, who did Free Solo. And this is about the 2018 rescue of the Thai youth soccer team from a flooded underground cave that captivated the world. And the film not only brings to life this extraordinary rescue, but also the courage and compassion of the rescuers and the shared humanity of people coming together from all over the world for a common cause. We thought that'd be a perfect complement for Live PC, Give PC. I got to see the film at the Tarrad Film Festival. Just standing ovations, unbelievable story. Even if you think you know it, there's so much more to it than you could possibly imagine. And then we are back with our Thursday night screenings. We've got a double feature of two short films called Rite of Passage and Home Lines, which is films about a ski adventure, a low-impact ski adventure, just as you're talking to Luke, talking about low carbon activities in the French Alps, and then closer to home about Utah Malinois' attempt to complete the Whirl, which is the Wasatch Ultimate Ridge Link Up, 36 miles over 2,000 feet of elevation game. And we'll have a Q&A after that. And then Dune, which I'm super excited about. It's one of my favorite films, Denis Villeneuve's much anticipated remake of the sci-fi classic. So a lot of great films coming up to entice people to come back to the theater and be immersed in storytelling again, as we used to do in pre-COVID times.
Okay, what are the COVID precautions being taken?
So we're still operating at limited capacity. We're about 40% capacity, so about 150 seats per show. We are still requiring masks for all patrons, without exception, unless you're sitting in your seat actively eating or drinking. And then, of course, have enhanced ventilation and cleaning protocols as well. But we are allowing people to bring their own bowls. People are asking a lot about that. You can, of course, still purchase your tickets online, but the box office is also now open an hour before showtime. So if you've got punch passes that are unused or free film coupons from volunteering with us, absolutely come up to the box office and use those. We're happy to redeem those and get you back into the movie theater.
Yeah. I mean, do you have anybody being turned away because of just a good turnout, or because you're only at 40% capacity still, right?
We're 40% capacity. It's been a slow buildup. It depends on the film. Some, of course, are more full than others, as is normal. Most movie theaters, about 125 seats. So we're still, you know, larger than average. We have not been turning away anyone yet. We're hoping we'll get some filled out shows with these upcoming films. But, you know, as people are coming back, what we're seeing is they remember how, you know, incredible it is, just the joy of seeing films on the big screen, and just that collective experience is so unique. You know, there's nothing that your home theater can replicate that compares to that. So as people are coming back, we're seeing them coming back again. And then new people. We have a lot of new people in our community who are just experiencing Park City Film for the first time. And it's kind of fun to invite them into our little community with our raffle and bring your own bowl for the popcorn. And so we're still, I would say averaging about 100 seats per show. So still plenty of room for people to walk up and be spontaneous as they go to the movies.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No, you can go to parkcityfilm.org to check out our trailers of upcoming films. Certainly get tickets, or you can get them at the door, as I said. You know, want to give a shout out to PJ Builders this weekend for underwriting the film. And just thank everyone that's been coming out. We had a great season at the drive-in, and we're looking forward to a great season back at the Jim Santee Auditorium. And if you're looking for volunteers opportunities, we are always looking for volunteers for our weekend film. So parkcityfilm.org for more information there.
Okay. Katie, thanks.
Thank you.
Katie Wang is executive director of Park City Film. Well, candidates for the Heber City Mayor and City Council took turns addressing the business community with the Heber Valley Chamber of Commerce on Tuesday. While they all said they would support small businesses, they had different approaches for doing so. KPCW's Ben Lassiter has more on that.
Both candidates for mayor, incumbent Kellyn Potter and Councilwoman Heidi Franco, took the stage at the Zermatt Conference Room in Midway. Three of the four candidates running for two city council seats also attended. Friends of Heber Valley member Yvonne Barney, medical scientist Bryce Hoover, and financial advisor Scott Phillips were there. Incumbent Wayne Hardman was away traveling in California. Hoover told the room he'd focus on bringing more foot traffic to Main Street. Barney went a step further to say she wouldn't support large-scale developments, but would focus resources on small ones.
I think the thing that we've seen most since post-COVID, and we're still in it, is the fact that there have been a lot of small businesses. That was our biggest loss during that time. A lot of businesses that lost their revenue, that lost their businesses. So I think it's important that we stay away from large format developments. I think it's important that we develop and upkeep our infrastructure in the downtown area, allowing small businesses to be in buildings that would thrive.
Barney and Hoover expressed skepticism over the current council's plans for the Downtown Economic Development Project, known as the CRA. City officials have described the CRA as the key to a more vibrant downtown that would attract tourists and shoppers, further growing the city tax base. Phillips said bringing a large national business to the reinvestment area is the best way to create tax revenues to fund downtown projects.
Small business is the community, and we need to be a business-friendly community. The CRA is going to produce millions of dollars of benefit, not only to the city, not only to the county, not only to the school district. Just imagine a full redevelopment of Main Street. That's the only way this is ever going to happen. Where will the money come from to redevelop Main Street without the CRA?
Using a CRA is a financial strategy the city enacted in July to use state tax revenues to reinvest in the downtown. With the CRA, only new tax revenues are used to fund reinvestment projects there. For example, a city study projects a new Smith's Marketplace could help generate up to $16 million in taxes over 20 years. Based on that estimate, the City Council approved an agreement Tuesday to help build a new Smith's in the future. Hoover said he'd rather look for ways to achieve that economic development by investing in small businesses and revitalizing existing buildings.
The CRA, in my mind, is to help small businesses, not large corporations. And if we're giving money to Smith's, for instance, to do a new development, if we're dumping money into, you know, a new Smith store, what's going to happen to the old Smith store? And also, I'm concerned about Main Street and dumping money into people's, you know, small businesses. So the city comes in, gives them money to improve their business, but then we've just doubled their taxes. But I don't want to tax small businesses out of the valley.
The candidates for mayor both said they'd listen to expert voices and their constituents to make decisions. Franco, the only councilor to vote against the agreement with Smith's Tuesday night, said the city should be careful committing large revenues from the CRA to big businesses.
To me, in the beginning, the CRA that we'd initially discussed on the city council was going to have the local business focus. The city council discussed about it being used for a local parking garage, right, for business facades and revitalization in the downtown area, but also for subsidies for essential workers that we as a city or a county or a school district, you know, also need to get as much as you're struggling to get workers.
Meanwhile, incumbent Mayor Potter suggested implementing the strategy on a case-by-case basis.
So what the CRA should do is create development that would not happen but for that investment from the CRA. It will create, like, there are places where someone could put some storage units and they might, and we might say, we really didn't want storage units there, but the zoning is there, they've got the entitlements, they're gonna do it because that's the best way they can make a pencil. Well, maybe with some investment from the CRA, they could do something a little bit better that will help create some better sales tax revenue, make something better for that area of town. Those are the kind of things.
On Friday, the candidates for Heber City Council will meet again on KPCW's Local News Hour from 8 to 9 a.m. To listen live, tune to 91.9 FM in Wasatch County or 91.7 in Summit County, or visit kpcw.org to stream the conversation during or after the broadcast. Ben Lassiter, KPCW News.